This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And that's why the climate lost is because the fossil fuel industry showed how strong it still is, how influential it still is in preventing real action from happening right now.
This week, as we inventory the things for which we're thankful, many of us may include some of the midterm election results in our accounting. Today on Sea Change Radio, we hear the second half of our discussion with John Storr of the New Haven Register and the Editorial Board Newsletter. We examine how Democrats have handled the gun debate over the past couple of decades and talk about the possibility of Beto O'Rourke running for president in 2020. Then we hear from Emily Atkin, a staff writer for The New Republic, who thinks that while there were victories for which environmentalists can be thankful, the failure of three different states to pass climate change-related bills on November 6th was a troubling reminder of the hard work that lies ahead. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and my guest is John Storr. John's a columnist at the New Haven Register and the editor and publisher of the Editorial Board. So, John, we were talking about Democrats being more progressive and not trying to run to the center, like Blue Dogs, who didn't fare so well on the whole on November 6th. But I wanted to talk for a moment about the gun debate and the way Democrats have framed it. Do you think it's a mistake? I tend to think it's a huge one, and at the very least, a lost opportunity and a good example of how to navigate more effectively in a divided country like this.
Well, I don't know if it is a huge mistake, because it seems to be working. You know, there's a passel of gun control laws that were passed by referendum, I think it was. And then there's a congresswoman who's just beat Karen Handel in Georgia, and she just won a district that hasn't gone to a Democrat in a generation. And she basically ran as the gun control candidate. Her son had been a victim of gun violence.
You're talking about Lucy McBath.
Thank you. Yes, I'm talking about her. And so that, you know, when one politician wins on a platform the way you describe it, that's incentive for others to keep doing it, you know, to replicate that success. So it seems to be working at least on the district level. I don't know if it would work state or national.
Well, here's my thesis about it. And I know it sounds crazy, but if you think about the healthcare debate, how Barack Obama took away the public option from a negotiating standpoint and just started basically from the middle, saying, I don't want a public option. I don't want socialized medicine. I want to bring down rates, and I want to make sure everybody has insurance and there's no more preconditions. But he took away that public option off the table. But if he had put the public option in play, we may have a much more palatable healthcare bill in the end. And similarly, the way the Republicans talk about abortion, you never hear a candidate saying, you know, I'm pro-life, but I think it's okay for abortions to happen in the first trimester. They never say that, right? Even if that's by far and away proven law, they always are like, no, they're killing babies. You got to stop it. It's alarmist, of course, and it's not very true. But they don't negotiate on those terms. They're firm in their belief. And I think if people just said, you know what, I don't believe that the Second Amendment should read, we need to have guns in our populace. It was arming a militia at the time. We can have that debate, but people have just given up on debating the Second Amendment. It is a debatable topic whether or not, I mean, if you go to any other country in the world, any developed country, guns are not prevalent. Policemen don't have guns in Japan. These are very large economies that function without having a populace armed to the teeth. So I think it's important to continue to fight from the left and then meet in the middle, as opposed to go to the middle and then meet halfway. Why not try to ban guns? Even when Obama won, saying the same things, like, I believe in the Second Amendment, I don't want to take away your guns. What happened the second he won? Gun sales went through the roof because everybody thought he was going to take away guns. So they don't believe you anyway. So why not exactly? Why not call their bluff? Yeah. Is my point.
Yeah, that's a good, and he's established the fact that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you make, I mean, anything he did
was bad to them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even if he was giving you a straight GOP talking point, it was going to be bad. And we know this, we just know this because of history, right? We know this because of what you just said. We know this because of Obamacare. I mean, Obamacare was a Republican policy proposal, right? And the Republicans turned it into, you know, the next coming of, you know, the end times. So I agree that we should not, it's really important to, like I said earlier, to have a liberal answer to any discussion. And, you know, liberal can be on a spectrum. It can be like, I'm absolutely against military firearms, the way Dick Blumenthal is here in Connecticut. You know, he's basically like, no way, you know, pistols are one thing, but you cannot have this, you know, period. And then I haven't heard anybody, any elected liberal figure have the argument about militia. I would be really interested to see that, to see how it was received among, you know, not conservatives, because they're going to just project something that's not there or whatever. But I'd like to see the reception among open-minded people, especially among Democrats, because they'll assess whether there's anything worth selling or not. You should never, I think we are moving into this period that of centrism not mattering as much. The whole, you know, even when Obama won, he was still carrying over the legacy of Bill Clinton, you know, and we saw that not so much in his rhetoric, but in Obama's governing stance, just as we said. But his rhetoric was something different, right? Mm-hmm. It was really like a call to action to be a better republic than we were in the past, right? And I think that kind of, this is what we're talking about, is small R republicanism or liberalism, if you want to call it that. But it's a, you know, calling on our fellow citizens to be better than they are, you know, to create a greater sense of morality between each other and between communities, you know, for doing the right thing for its own sake, whether or not there's a material reward. You know, those are kinds of values that you can establish that as the framework and then fit whatever policy you want to stick in there. And in this case, you know, what is the greater good when it comes to gun control? Well, you know, we may have some limits on individual freedoms, some, you know, but we're going to have greater safety, right? And that's worth the trade-off. You know, if most people were kind of given those options, like, okay, well, are you going to, you know, protect this man's right of having a bazooka, or are you going to protect this community's right to live in peace and safety? that's a winnable argument if it's put that way, you know. And unfortunately, it's not put that way yet. But it seems like we're moving in that direction, especially after Parkland and after those kids.
I just think it goes back to speaking your mind and not trying to please everybody. People say, well, it's in the Constitution. Well, so is, you know, slavery was allowed in the Constitution. Women weren't allowed to vote in the Constitution. So I think we can evolve as a people. And when you see what's working in other societies where they don't have mass shootings every day, then I think it's fair to maybe stray from the opinings of 18th century slave owners. My point is more from a framing standpoint. I think it would be much more effective in general, maybe not just in guns, but in general, people speak their minds. I think that's why Beto O'Rourke's answer to that NFL question was so well received, because he just said what he believed. That's the takeaway I had from last week's election, John.
Yeah. Well, he's really interesting because he's good at that. You know, he's smart. He knows the issues, and he genuinely, he seems to genuinely care, you know, a lot of politicians don't.
And I think if he runs again, if he runs for president, I don't see how he doesn't flip Texas.
Yeah.
If you flip Texas, you win the election. Texas plus New York plus California plus Illinois, that's 142 electoral votes right there.
Right, right.
You don't even need Florida and Ohio.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. He's, you know, occasionally societies produce really great statesmen and women, and but most of the time they're mediocre. You know, they're just kind of, you know, phoning it in, saying what everybody wants them to say, and then the hard part is figuring out what everybody wants them to say instead of just saying what they really believe.
Yes, being authentic in today's day and age, I think, is more important than ever. Because we think we know each other more because of social media.
Right.
He's a columnist at the New Haven Register, and he's the editor and publisher of the Editorial Board, which is a daily newsletter about politics, which is a subscriber-based model. And I strongly urge Sea Change Radio listeners to go and sign up for it. It's terrific, and you got to support grassroots journalism, and I applaud your efforts there, John. John Storr, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Got my prayer. I should have been happy. Yeah, I'll still be there. Some could have come and taken me away. But the main man fell. Still should be here another day. And that's why I got to be
thankful.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta be.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Emily Atkin. She is an environmental journalist and she's a staff writer at The New Republic. Emily, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you cover kind of the intersection between politics and clean energy, climate change for The New Republic. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the midterm elections. You actually wrote a couple pieces that I think with time we can kind of look back and have a slightly different take on them. But you wrote one article in particular that I wanted to highlight because I think a lot of these climate change efforts that did not pass were kind of lost over the much more covered races such as in Florida and Georgia, et cetera. It was entitled America Voted, the Climate Lost. Why don't you chronicle some of the amendments and ballot initiatives that did not pass around the country on election day?
Sure. And I'll preface it by saying that a lot of people disagree with me, especially environmental groups and people who are really looking to build momentum for climate change in the environment. You know, they see a headline that says the climate lost. And a lot of people who are, you know, optimists are quick to point out that actually there were a lot of wins. You know, there were a lot of Democrats took back the House, and there were some statewide races where, you know, like the Maryland legislature now has a supermajority of clean energy politicians who are going to vote through a 100% clean energy bill. And I will, you know, I'll concede that there were a lot of victories like that, smaller victories that will hopefully result in better conversations around climate change or perhaps a more adversarial Congress that won't pass some really aggressive anti-climate things that Trump proposes. However, my argument that the climate lost is because in the midterm elections, there were a few things that voters could have passed that would have started having an immediate impact on climate change. You know, the state of Washington had a ballot measure to implement the first ever carbon tax or the first ever price on carbon in the United States. And that failed. But if that had gone through, it would have been a really aggressive measure to put a fee on carbon emissions from big companies in the state. That could have happened immediately. That would have had an immediate effect. The state of Arizona could have passed a ballot measure that would have, started the process of having the state have 100% renewable energy by the year 2030. And that didn't happen. And in Colorado, they could have passed a ballot measure that would have all but pretty much banned fracking across the state, which wouldn't have had a huge impact on climate change, but it would have had a big impact on that industry. And in all three of those races, voters chose not to pass those measures. I don't think that's because voters don't care about climate change. It's because the fossil fuel industry spent cumulatively, over $100 million on those races, making, I think, all of them the most expensive ballot measure fights ever in the state. And that's why the climate lost, is because the fossil fuel industry showed how strong it still is, how influential it still is in preventing real action from happening right now.
And when we talk about the fossil fuel industry, was there any kind of commonality in terms of the funding with these three measures in Arizona, Colorado, and Washington in terms of, was it like Koch brothers money, or was it more specific to the industry that was under attack in each measure?
It was more specific to the industry that was under attack. These were the companies that would have been directly affected by these policies. In Colorado, you would see that, $30 million of funding to defeat the initiative came from two gas companies. There's political interests behind them, but really this is capitalism. Honestly, it's about companies that see a threat to their profit margins and realizing that spending this much money to defeat these policy efforts still saves them money in the long run.
And maybe you can direct us to some of the climate change-oriented measures that did pass around the country. Did anything of note pass on Tuesday the 7th?
Yeah. The state of Florida passed a ban on offshore drilling on its shores. And the state of Nevada passed a 100% renewable energy ballot initiative by 2030, despite fossil fuel-funded efforts. But I think cumulatively out of nine ballot measures that were on the ballot across the country, five failed, which is an overall failure. And the Washington failure was the real loss for the climate, because at this point, the IPCC, the UN, the big UN body of international scientists on climate change, put out a report basically saying that we have 12 years to fully implement the changes we need to keep global warming from reaching catastrophic irreversible levels, right? Mm-hmm. That's not 12 years to solve it. That's 12 years to get it all done before this stuff happens. And there's really not a great way to do that unless you start seeing some sort of price, a fee, a tax, something on emissions, the same way we tax income to tax carbon pollution. And so it was a big deal that was even a possibility that we were going to get our first carbon fee in Washington, and that we didn't. That's a bigger loss than I think any of the other losses.
Oh, I am just a vagabond, a drifter on the run. And eloquent profanity, it rolls right off my tongue. And I have dined in palaces, drunk wine with kings and queens. But darling, oh darling, you're the best thing I ever seen. Won't you roll me easy? Oh, slow and easy. Take my independence with no apprehension, no tension. You're walking, talking, paradise, sweet paradise.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Emily Atkin. She's an environmental reporter for the New Republic. So, Emily, you were talking about how America voted and lost on in terms of the climate because of these initiatives that did not pass in certain states that would have ensured immediate action on the climate. But if these bills had passed in Washington, Colorado, would we be looking at this as a big win for the climate? I think ultimately 2016 was such a huge setback for any action from this country that these are, I think they would have been almost hollow. We couldn't just declare some great victory for the climate, right?
Right. Well, and I think we were speaking in black and white terms, like, did we save the climate or did we ruin it again, right?
Right.
That's not what I mean at all. And I'll tell you, the process of doing election night stories, right, is that you write two pieces for two outcomes and then like a third one for another outcome, and you switch it based on, you know that that all these things could pass or all of them could fail or some could fail and some could pass. You know, I had one written that was America voted and the climate won. And that was if all these things had passed. And I actually, to be honest with you, I expected them to pass. I really thought I was going to be running that piece based on my own, you know, looking at how things were going and how voters, especially in, you know, a state like Washington that's already pretty blue, realizing how important things like this were and rejecting the Trump administration, things like that. I was surprised to see all of them failed. And to me, it really just demonstrated the continued power of the fossil fuel industry. Because I think that if all of those initiatives had passed, it would have really shown that, you know, Americans understand the dire nature of this crisis and they are not being fooled anymore. And I don't think this election showed that.
Well, let's move to some of the candidates who won and lost within the lens of climate change. So Sean Casten won Illinois' 6th congressional district. He was a Democrat, and he had climate change explicitly on his platform. Did that set him apart from his colleagues, in your opinion?
Sure. Sean Casten's in Illinois' 6th. Illinois' 6th has been held by a Republican congressperson for 40 years. The congressman that he beat, Republican Peter Raskin, he is a six-term incumbent and, you know, has called climate science junk science before, you know. And Sean Casten, on the other hand, was a clean energy businessman. He made money off of trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by capturing the recycled, capturing the excess energy of other companies and then using that. And so when he hit the campaign trail, he talked about the business opportunities, the money that he made, like the economy that we could grow by fighting this problem. And voters responded to that along with his other messages, right? You know, he talked about healthcare a lot, Supreme Court things. You know, it wasn't the only thing he talked about, but he was different from other candidates he talked very openly and honestly about climate change, not as an environmental problem, like, oh my God, we have to save the trees and the corals. He was like, you know, this is an existential problem, but we have so many opportunities. And I know because I made this money and, like, you know, I want windmills and I want solar panels and there's all this tech that we can invest in. And it'll be so great. And people responded to that. And he flipped a 40-year Republican district from red to blue. And I think that's probably the biggest climate win, in my opinion, of this election, is the idea that logic that you can't talk about climate change in a red district, you can't talk about it in a compelling way, that was obviously false.
See, I look at it through a slightly different angle, because I think it's much more, the climate is much more of an issue of rich versus poor right now, even though I think there's a great argument to be made that clean energy makes a lot more economic sense on every level. But for those who are struggling, working two or three jobs, there are a lot of regressive, seemingly regressive policies that hit somebody's pocketbook right in the short term. It's hard to ask somebody who's struggling to look in terms of long-term issues. And that's why I think Democrats focused on healthcare and other more immediate things that could kind of bring that 40% of the electorate that traditionally doesn't vote. I think that's what this election was all about, was those people who have not come out. I think that's where the opportunity really lies ultimately for the Democrats, is to stop trying to assuage that creamy center of the American electorate, that 10% of independent voters. If you look at Illinois' 6th congressional district, in terms of demographics, it's the richest by far in Illinois. So yes, it's great that a red district can kind of embrace a congressman who understands the realities and enormity of the climate issue, but I think it's much more of an economic issue, and that's why I think you saw Democrats not necessarily honing in on that issue during the midterms.
Sure, and I actually agree with you on that. You know, it's not going to be, don't burden poor voters by talking about this existential problem. You know, they have needs that they need to solve right now. Like, a lot of people can't really afford to pay attention to right now. But my issue, and the reason I was optimistic about this race in particular, is because, listen, the Democrats weren't talking about climate change in districts like Sean Casten's district, in the districts where there were, where they had the opportunity to flip those districts, right? And there were a lot of rich voters who do have the privilege and time to think about climate change, but aren't, because they don't see the opportunity. Ultimately, I think if we're going to solve the problem so that the most vulnerable in our society, you know, don't get screwed by it, we have to convince those voters who are more well off that they have incentive towards the problem too. And so you have to make a different argument. And I think that Sean Casten's argument was effective is really instructive.
And if you were a Democratic strategist and you had a client who was a little reticent about talking about climate change in an upcoming election, what would you tell them are the kind of bullet points that will resonate with an electorate?
Well, I'm not a Democratic strategist, but I will say what Sean Casten told me in our interview, which is that talking about climate change was a jumping off point to talking about so many other things. He said that on the campaign trail, it was just a door opener for him to talk about other problems, because once you start talking about climate change and the reality that, you know, that it's been painted as an unsolvable problem, black and white, Democrat, Republican, there's no middle ground, but that's not the reality. Voters start to relate that to other problems, their health care, the broken immigration system. They start to see how issues get framed as black and white or solvable or unsolvable, and that's not the case. You know, talking about climate change also is a great way to talk about other things, because other issues because climate change affects every part of the economy, you know, agriculture, insurance, it affects immigration. We're going to get more immigrants, refugees trying to come to our shores as the sea level rises, et cetera, et cetera. It's a can opener.
She's an environmental reporter for The New Republic, Emily Atkin. Emily, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Led Zeppelin, Sly and the Family Stone, and Little Feat. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.